Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled Getting to Know the European Union, Portugal, and Spain. Speaking will be Joa de Valera, Ambassador of Portugal to the United States, and Carlos Westendorp, Ambassador of Spain to the United States. Moderating tonight's discussion is Alan Berger, Senior Editorial Writer for the Boston Globe. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzenska-Gross.
I welcome you this evening for our conversation and discussion entitled Getting to Know the European Union. This evening we are going to talk about Spain and Portugal. We are very, very lucky to have two speakers who are quite extraordinary. One is an ambassador to the United States from Portugal, the country that is now holds now the presidency of the European Union, Mr. João de Valera. And we also have the ambassador of Spain to the United States, Mr. Carlos Westendorp. And as usual, the discussion will be moderated by Alan Berger, who is a senior editorial writer for Boston Globe. Let me introduce the speakers to you. Our first speaker will be Ambassador João de Valera, who first joined the diplomatic service in 1974. Both of our speakers are very experienced diplomats, and their curriculum vitae is very, very long and very distinguished. So I will just pull out some of the positions that I find more important just for this occasion, without really going through all of them. Mr. de Valera was appointed the ambassador of Portugal to the United States in January of this year. And as I told you, he's representing Portugal, and Portugal is the has a president, rotating presidency of European Union. His workload is, I think, even heavier than usual. He served also at the embassy in Madrid, at the permanent representation of the European communities in Brussels. In 1998, he was appointed ambassador to Dublin. In 2001, he became director general of European Affairs, and from February to May 2002, served as delegate to the Convention on the Future of Europe. He was then appointed ambassador in Berlin, a position he held until taking up the present position in Washington. Mr. Carlos Westendorp became ambassador of Spain to the United States in September of 2004. He joined the Spanish diplomatic service in 1966. He previously served as a member of the Autonomous Community of the Madrid Parliamentary Assembly, and then as a member of the European Parliament and as High Representative for the implementation of the peace agreement in Bosnia and Herzegovina. In addition, he has served as his country's permanent representative to the United Nations, Minister of Foreign Affairs, as well as at various other posts for European communities. And many of you know our moderator, Alan Berger, who, as I said, is a senior writer, editorial writer for the Boston Globe. Thank you very much. And Mr. Ambassador, please.
Thank you very much. I hope I won't get lost in my manuscript notes, but I'll try to do my best. But I would like first to commend Boston University for this initiative. I think it contributes very usefully to raise the American awareness of the European Union when we celebrate its 50th birthday and the extraordinary success, that's something you have already mentioned, but I would like to repeat, of this unique experience of voluntarily shared sovereignty. And for doing it in a way that does not conceal the basic elements of diversity, the changing nature and the underlying complexities of the European integration process, if I understood what happened in the meetings here before. It is also a privilege to be in this stage together with Ambassador Carlos Westendorp, whom I frequently had the pleasure to meet in the course of his distinguished diplomatic and political careers. and to address this audience when Portugal holds for the third time the presidency of the European Union. Since your arrangements favor the questions and answers segment of this session, I shall be brief, while at the same time trying to, with my introductory remarks, to stimulate and to enlarge the scope of the subsequent discussion. Contradicting what many predicted or feared, and there were many in Portugal at that time, the Portuguese integration in the European Union was not bedeviled by any disastrous consequences, nor did it lead to a breakdown when it came to adopting the country's economic and social structures, or when the public administration was called to face wider and more demanding responsibilities, both in the front line in Brussels and in the numerous national backstages. On the contrary, overall, the experience was a major success, and we soon found the right way within the working methods and specificities of the EU's complex institutional framework. We took advantage of the favorable conditions offered by the internal market and by the Union's structural policy, while globally reacting in a positive way to a difficult new environment of permanent negotiation and of enhanced competition. Even if sometimes with unavoidable hiccups and delays, we managed to make compatible and to gradually integrate within the European framework our specific foreign policy interests and concerns, intimately linked with the dense networks of historical relationships built up over the past centuries. An example of what I just said can be observed, for instance, within the priorities of the current Portuguese presidency, where the materialization of a new strategic partnership between the European Union and Brazil, or the persistent attempt to create a new global architecture for the relations between the European Union and the African continent, occupy a prominent place. Finally, we not only adapted to the intense pace of change that shook the European Union in the past 20 years through successive cycles of enlargement and major treaty changes, the last one being the Treaty of Lisbon, which, as you know, or you probably know, will be signed on 13th of December next, but also played an active role in the definition of that process of change. Portugal made the strategic option and the necessary homework to join the more advanced expressions of integration within the European Union sphere, being a founding member of the Euro and of the Schengen space. And the economic progress, the impressive infrastructural build-up, the modernization of the financial system, and the human development that accompanied integration, despite inevitable difficulties and a pace we would prefer to be swifter, allowed it to move from the category of countries that were almost exclusively exporters of labor force and importers of capital to join the club of those who also import foreign workers and export capital, following, by the way, a pattern that is gradually widening its geographic boundaries, the USA not being absent of the process of internationalization of the Portuguese enterprises in this moment. This evolution favored and was also favored by the positive attitude adopted in Lisbon towards the European integration process since the beginning. And it represents, I believe, one more expression of the adequacy and vitality inherent to the sui generis model of shared sovereignty that has been introduced in Europe, totally in opposition, and I think this is a very important point, to the zero-sum game logic that prevailed in the past before the signature of the Treaty of Rome, with the tragic consequences we all witnessed and suffered from in the past century. This same evolution offers some interesting clues for those of you who might feel curious to approach the enlargement-deepening dichotomy, a dichotomy which crucially lays in the center of the EU developments, past and future, and wish to go beyond the conventional wisdom that surrounds it. It is true that the two terms of this dichotomy are by definition, from a static point of view, contradictory, in the sense that new members mean additional elements of heterogeneity and a multiplied set of different interests that complicate the decision-making process and bring a perceived risk of potential dilution to whatever was previously designed as a common purpose and ambition. But it is also true that enlargements were finally not condemned to be followed by a weakening of the global system. Conversely, they fueled compensation movements of adaptation that many times moved the integration process forward with a pace and a purpose that might have not been possible to reach in the pre-accession situation. And I would dare to say, and that's where I wanted to come at this point, that never was this so true as with the Portuguese and Spanish accessions, which were linked with three of the most ambitious and integrationist defining moments of European Union history. I mean the Single European Act, the Treaty of Maastricht, and the creation of the multi-annual financial perspectives exercise. But one of the most significant and immediate consequences of the simultaneous accession of Portugal and Spain regards the Iberian space. The wider European framework and the had the virtue to provide the instruments and the political opportunity to tackle historical inertia, misunderstandings, and artificial separations that could not have been so easily and so naturally overcome were they the result of, a purely bilateral track. The relationship moved to a pattern of normality and acquired a degree of maturity and interconnection at the political, economic, social, and human levels that has no parallel in the long history of the two countries, for the first time participating together in the same geostrategic area of interest, not only the European Union, but also NATO, Council of Europe, OSCE, whose presidency Spain is now in charge of, and the Ibero-American framework. Convergent interests in development of some important EU policies also helped to build a natural network of contacts and consultation between the two countries. This very positive outcome influenced other experiences of integration, namely the Mercosur, following a trail where the well-succeeded re-establishment of democracy in Portugal and Spain had already inspired and sustained the expansion of democratic regimes in Latin America and elsewhere. Portugal has taken large benefits from its accession to the European Union, this is well known, but has also given positive contributions to the European Union, not only through more visible brands like the Lisbon Strategy or what is to become the Treaty of Lisbon, but through daily work within European institutions, through added value brought to the development of relations with different areas of the world, and through gestures of commitment with the pursuit of the European integration process. The Portuguese foreign policy, based in four pillars of European integration, transatlantic relations, the Portuguese diaspora, and what I could call the development and organization of the wide Portuguese-speaking world, and the Portuguese-European policy are very stable and basically immune to government change in Portugal, irrespective of their ideological color. I think it might be interesting for you to have this introduction concluded with a mention to the basic principles and objectives that, in my opinion, have constantly inspired the Portuguese action in Europe. I would mention a certain number of them. As I already said before, compatibility, integration, and ideally mutual reinforcement of the interests and preferential relations Portugal maintains with the outer world. Within this context, a strong Europe and a solid transatlantic relationship should be not only compatible, but mutually sustaining objectives. Development of common foreign security policy and European security defense policy in a transatlantic harmony. Defense of the principle of equality of states and of a balanced distribution of power among small, medium, and bigger member states, with plain rejection of attempts to form directory-like structures within the European Union. Preference for the so-called community method, as opposed to the reintroduction of intergovernmental practices within the European Union structure. Defense of solidarity and social and economic cohesion as a pillar of the European project. Defense of the Portuguese language within the institutional system. Participation in the front line of the integration process. Continued support to the countries that applied and qualified to enlargement. Caution, and I would say personally reserves, about the multiplication of flexibility models and exceptional clauses that may jeopardize the consistency and unity of purpose of the Union, as well as the nature and degree of commitment implied by membership, and consequent demand to closely monitor their development and implementation. A favorable attitude towards the extension of European Union competences beyond the mere economic sphere, with a particular interest in new areas like migrations, social affairs, fundamental rights, and the progressive enrichment of the concept of European citizenship, something that in the united Europe of diversities, I would say, we are aiming at, is not something meant to replace, but to be added to the national citizenship in the benefit of our citizens. I may stop here. I think I've been too long. Thank you very much for your attention.
Good evening. Thank you very much to Boston University for this opportunity. It's a great thing to be able to speak together with my Portuguese colleague, because our destinies are linked together, because we share the same piece of land in the Iberian Peninsula, as you know, and we joined the European Union at the same time. And we have had together the same type of experiences. Let me just say a few words about our common experiences. One is that Spain and Portugal were the first two countries who have liberal constitutions in Europe at the beginning of the 19th century. But very soon we both entered into decadence and political, economic decadence and political fragility, leading towards dictatorships. We missed the mingled in European affairs in the First World War, in the Second World War, and we lived in isolation, more Spain than Portugal, because Portugal had special relationship with the United Kingdom, and at the same time has been a more traditionally Atlanticist country than Spain. Spain and Portugal now look at each other face to face. We are close friends. We are close allies. And at the same time, we share the same type of Europeanism, so to speak, and defend the same values within the European Union, because we really believe that it is the best possible place to be, even if nowadays we are living difficult times. But Europe has lived many difficult times, and we have overcome all of them. And I hope that with the Treaty of Lisbon, we'll put Europe back to the rails that we have been derailed two years ago. We are trying to digest many things. One of them is the big enlargement, the big bang of the enlargement. And this is not easy. We were 12 countries, more or less homogeneous, more or less coming from the same experiences, perhaps except Spain and Portugal, because, as I told you, we came from dictatorships. But the European Union has been completely a revolution for both of us, because now we are living together, we're looking at the face, to the face, face to face, and at the same time we have been benefiting of belonging to this family. In the first place, because we have overcome the difficulties, the political difficulties of the years, the second half of the last century, and at the same time, the economic fragility of our two nations. So the experience of Spain and Portugal are very positive, and I am going now to refer mainly to Spain. When we joined the European Union, we wanted to be equal to the other countries of Europe, that is to say, to overcome our fragility, political fragility, and to overcome also our economic backwardness. And both objectives have been attained by Spain's joining the European Union. We had an attempt of a coup d'etat in 81, as you will, perhaps you are too young to remember, but I can tell you that this was quite easily overcome thanks to the democratic commitment by our institutions, and mainly by the King of Spain. and also belonging to the European Union, which is a kind of a vaccine against autocratic adventures. But at the same time, Spain, who was, when we joined, had an average income of 75% of the average income of the European Union, nowadays, in the year 2007, we are 100% in the average of the European Union. That is to say, we are totally in the average income of the European Union. Spain has been growing in the last 10 years at a pace of 4%, 3.5% of the gross national product. The rest of the European Union countries, the average has been growing half of that amount of growth. So we have been able to catch up with the average of the other countries of the European Union. So this has been a very important achievement of Spain and also of Portugal. And now we have also introduced into the European Union some other preoccupations, some other responsibilities, and Ambassador Barrera has mentioned some of them. Let me just add, he has mentioned Mercosur, but of course Latin America is also something that Spain can, and in Portugal, can help to develop and to be more present in the international sphere, because Latin America, Portugal with Brazil, Spain with other Latin American nations, we speak the same languages, and we have an experience that may be also very useful for the Latin American countries. And this is one of the assets that both countries, Spain and Portugal, may present when talking to the United States. Together, we can do a lot of things in the Western Hemisphere, and we can share the same type of goals, although sometimes we may differ in the approach, how to get to these common goals. For instance, democracy in Cuba. We both want a democratic Cuba, that's very clear, because we want for Cuba the same as we have in our own country, that is to say democracy, freedom, and liberties. But perhaps we have a different approach. We don't think that by an embargo policy is going to attain the objective of democracy in Cuba. On the contrary, perhaps it is going to become more difficult to achieve that goal. But apart from that, we can share the same goals, so we can work together in the democratization of Cuba, in the situation of some Latin American countries which have a trend towards autocracy. And we can do a lot together, because Spain is the second investor in Latin America, as you know, after the United States, and our firms are very present. And whenever you have firms present in a continent, you can have an influence which is not only the language or the common culture, but it's also real politics. On the other hand, one of the advantages of being in the European Union is to be able to sustain and to support one of the European Union's objectives, which is the transatlantic relationship, that is to say, a good relations with the United States and Canada. Because we belong to the same family of nations, we share the same values, and we are suffering the same challenges, the same scourges, the scourge of terrorism, of organized crime, and the world is too complex for one only country to cope with these challenges. So we need to cooperate together, and transatlantic relationship is the best of all possible actions we can do, because we share the same values, as I told you. Spain has been an active member of the European Union, but at the same time an active believer in a good, sound, equal, balanced transatlantic relationship. This is why, perhaps, we had in the past, when Spain fulfilling an electoral promise. The new government of Spain had to withdraw the troops from Iraq. We had a certain bumpy road in the relationship with the United States. But this has been overcome, well, first of all, because it is evident that also in the United States, it was not it's not nowadays a unanimously sustained policy. On the contrary, it is less and less sustained. And at the same time, we all believe that we have to help each other in order to overcome the situation. So we are doing that not only in Iraq. Spain is not participating with troops, but is participating, is supporting the training and equipping and reconstruction of the country. And we are also working together with the United States in other peacekeeping operations in Kosovo, in Afghanistan, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, because, as I told you, the world is too complex for one only country to be able to cope with these challenges. So this is another characteristic of the Spanish policy, that is to say that we want a sound balance transatlantic relationship, but not too imbalanced as it was in the previous government when they had to follow the direct policy of intervention in Iraq, which was not accepted by the majority of the Spanish population, as you may remember. So this is, in a nutshell, the main characteristics of our appartenance to the European Union, and now we are facing the ratification of the Treaty of Lisbon, which will replace the Constitution, the so-called Constitution, which was refused by a couple of countries, in the Netherlands and in France, as you will remember, and we had to make some concessions, some arrangements in order to save the essential goals of this constitution. And I think, I am quite confident that we can come to a happy end and at last it will be ratified. It is not a sufficient condition for Europe to work. It is a necessary one, but it's not enough. It's not enough if there is not enough political will to act together. Europe has its own values, its own values which are shared with the United States, but values which are differently seen from the European continent. And together we can influence each other in order to be able to have a better world. And this is why we need the constitutional treaty, the Treaty of Lisbon, but we need also a political will to be able to act and to influence in foreign policy and in world affairs. If Europe has this political will, and this is a big if Europe has this political will, I think we'll be able to influence other friends, for instance, the United States, for a better world. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both of you. First question I want to ask is an attempt to tie together what you said about the Iberian Peninsula's special relations and concern for Latin America and the whole matter of European integration. One of the projects of the Constitution and I guess the Treaty of Lisbon is for a unified European Union foreign policy. There was the project of one foreign minister. Now, Spain's king told Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, could you please shut up? My question is, if there were a unified foreign policy with one foreign minister, would Spain have a problem with that one foreign minister? And secondly, what kind of resonance does that statement from someone who's regarded as a symbol, even though a monarch, of the return of democracy on the Iberian Peninsula, what kind of resonance does his statement to Chavez have in Latin America?
Well, I think the the king's words were the words of somebody who belongs to the same family. Otherwise, if you are not of the same family, you don't dare to pronounce that kind of words, which are, it may sound too harsh if you are not. This is why perhaps nobody has told Chavez that before. Well, he didn't say shut up. He said, why don't you shut up? Which is, has a different nuance. In any case, he was listening to Prime Minister Zapatero trying to convey to Hugo Chavez, who had pronounced very nasty words against the previous Spanish Prime Minister Aznar, calling him a fascist, that Zapatero was trying to convey to Chavez that even if we do not agree with Aznar's policies and attitudes, because we belong to the antipodes, in ideological antipodes in our country, you have to respect a person who has been elected by the Spanish people. When he was trying, Zapatero, to convey this message to Chavez, which is quite a logical message, Chavez didn't stop, and he continued. He went on and on and on and speaking and saying that kind of nasty words. Then the king said, "Why don't you shut up?" Which, by the way, is now a slogan in Venezuela. It's written everywhere, and said, "Why don't you shut up?" I think this is going to have some internal consequences, but I hope we will all be able to overcome the diplomatic incident. At the end of the day, you see, the United States and Venezuela, or the United States and Cuba, have a different kind of relationship from Spain's, because we belong to the same family. We have a lot of grandfathers and grandsons and in Cuba or Venezuela, and it is very difficult for the Spanish government, any government, no matter the color, to be in bad terms with a Venezuelan or Cuban government, even if we would rather prefer other type of governments. But, you know, this is something that we cannot have the luxury of having difficult relations with them. So this is the... When we have discussions with our American friends, it is we have to convey to them that we cannot say the same type of things that an American government can say to them. But this is life.
Well, as also a member of the Ibero-American family, I don't want to develop this subject, but I would just like to recall that you probably don't know that, but... Portugal has in Venezuela our second biggest community in Latin America. After Brazil, it's in Venezuela. So this might be a curious element for you and desired by the hundreds of thousands of people. But coming to your part of your question, I mean, you mentioned also the EU foreign policy. I would make a mention about what we have in the new treaty in foreign policy and why the new treaty gives better conditions to the European Union to enhance its position towards the external world. I would start with something the Spanish ambassador said before. He said, I mean, we have a treaty, we have instruments, we have a framework, but of course if you have not the will behind it, this will be just instruments. But even if we know that instruments and organs tend to create their functions lately, so we have to have a good combination of the two. But since you mentioned these instruments, what I wanted to say is that you said, Minister of Foreign Affairs of the European Union, this might or not happen. I mean, what we do with this treaty is a step forward in terms of having a streamlined common policy in foreign policy in the European Union. And basically with the fact that the European Union Minister of Foreign Affairs, actually he is not called that anymore, that was in the constitutional treaty, which was, as you know, refused, is called High Representative, but still has the basic same functions as it was foreseen in the constitutional treaty. But what is the big change? The biggest change is that the gentleman who will be responsible for this task, he will do what more or less what three different people are doing now. I'm not saying that we are approaching Kissinger's dream of having a unique telephone number in Brussels to call, but we are somehow approaching this subject, because he will, this new high representative will do what Mr. Javier Solana is doing now as high representative for foreign policy, what Mrs. Ferrero-Waldner is doing as the commissioner responsible for external relations, and he will also be doing a part or a great part of what the present Minister of Foreign Affairs of the of the country that holds the presidency has, because this new gentleman, as I said, will be heading or chairing the Foreign Affairs Council, Foreign Policy Council in Brussels. So there is this new elements which suddenly go into the direction of a bigger integration. But this does not mean, of course, I said this is a new step. This does not mean that foreign policy disappear in all member states. It's not true. There will be national foreign policies. But as I said, the common element of foreign policy will be streamlined and reinforced with this new situation, and also with the creation of, for the first time, of EU external service, where you'll have people from the Commission, Secretariat of the Council, and diplomats from member states. Are you a volunteer for that?
I would.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask one other thing, because we should go to questions from the audience. And this is a bit of a softball, I suppose, but it seems to me that Spain has been quite successful in creating a kind of balance between centralism and regional autonomy, and that it is a model of sorts that a lot of other countries with problems of conflicts with minorities that want independence or autonomy could learn from. One thinks of Turkey today or Sri Lanka or Pakistan. But I wonder to what extent is this a model within Europe? And is there an influence? I know that Spain has asked Basque and Catalan languages to be part of the European Union set of official languages. Is this something that can be adopted elsewhere in Europe?
Well, we are living in a world where it's so complex that national states are becoming too small to solve big problems in the world. So this is why they need a broader alliances like the European Union or the transatlantic relationship, etc. And also, at the same time, there are problems which are very near the citizen, very very close to the most smaller units, for instance, the cities and even the regions, which are difficult to solve at national state, and you need to devolve these kind of questions to smaller units, political units. So this is why I think the distribution of power within a country such as in Spain, it's something which is going to be inevitable. United States is a federation. There are trends in other countries. For instance, in France, there are some regions which are now claiming for more autonomy, in the United Kingdom also. I don't know if what is going to be the answer by the majority of the people in these countries, but in Spain it is clear that language is a matter of national identity, and it's difficult to give an homogeneous system to the whole nation if you have units which are very different culturally and linguistically. I don't think this is a model for anybody, but it is something that was inevitable for Spain. And whenever other country asks us about the experience, we say, well, it's a difficult experience because it's not an easy question to solve. There are people, as you know, in Spain, in the Basque Country, who would like to have independence, and also in Catalonia. Fortunately, they are a minority. And unfortunately, a very small minority are not accepting that, to do that peacefully, but they use the terror as a weapon to attain their objective. So this is a problem we are having, and it is more or less solved, little by little, but it's not yet settled.
Ambassador Wessendorp mentioned a certain number of similarities between the historical trajectory of Portugal and Spain, and I very much agree with them. But as he also pointed out, there are some differences. Well, one of them being, for instance, and since we go to, if we consider the evolution after accession, Spain, for instance, took enormous benefit in the agricultural sector that Portugal, unfortunately, did not at the same level. Another difference being the fact that, for instance, even during the dictatorship, Portugal was already member of NATO and member of EFTA. So we had an experience of European economic integration a bit, nothing to be compared with the European Union, but nevertheless we had this sort of experience of economic opening, which was some years ahead of Spain. Well, another difference being we both had the two constitutions, the two first constitutions in Europe, but another difference is that, for instance, Portugal abolished death penalty as in 1863, which is 1863, yes. Mm-hmm. That's a long, long time ago. But, this is where, of course, there is an historical difference. The Portuguese experience is of a unified state, with the exception of the Azores and Madeira, which are regions in Portugal. And we even had the experience of a referendum in Portugal which tried, against this current or this stream, tried to introduce a regionalization process in Portugal and was refused by 70% of the Portuguese people who are more linked. But, the fact that this idea was launched has to do with what has been said before. Even in Portugal, there is an obvious discussion about how you have to deal with proximity. And if it is not regionalization, a movement towards decentralization is certainly happening.
I invite you to, those of you who have questions, to go to the microphone.
I would like to address my question primarily to His Excellency, the Ambassador of Spain. My question essentially concerns the protection of minorities, minority policies within the European Union. Now, perhaps I better identify myself. I'm an American of Hungarian extraction, and as I'm sure the ambassadors know, but perhaps not everybody in the audience knows, Hungary was partitioned after the First World War at Trianon, which is in Versailles, whereby it lost 72% of its territory and about 60-some-odd percent of its population, of which one-third of the ethnic Hungarian population became separated from the mother country. Now, these population segments survive and of course, form fairly large contiguous minorities in the surrounding countries. And it seems that the minority rights of these people do not seem to be improving. Essentially, European policies, whatever the European policies are for the protection of minorities, do not seem to be especially effective in securing the rights of these Hungarian-speaking minorities, some of which, notably those in Romania and in Slovakia, essentially are pressing for some kind of autonomy. But in any case, my specific question is, do you foresee any European policies for the furtherance of minority rights within the European Union?
Well, I think the protection of minorities is one of the main objectives of the European values and the European Union. And as far as the Hungarian minorities, we firmly believe, and I was wrong, but I thought that in the framework of OECD first OSCE and in the framework of the different arrangements, this situation in Romania, the Hungarian minorities, and in Slovakia, and also in Vojvodina, in the former Yugoslavia, which is now integrated into Serbia, I thought this the situation was much more better recognized than it was previously, but I may be wrong. I don't know. Perhaps the ambassador of Portugal knows about that.
No, certainly not about that. But the question here is to know. I mean, I think you went a bit ahead in defining what the rights of these minorities would be, and I mean, I don't go to the point of defining if a right of autonomy inside a state for a specific ethnic minority is something to be recognized or supported or not. I mean, there I think we are going a bit too far in what is the definition of protection of minorities. That's I think that's a question that will go a bit further on. What would be the EU competencies, I mean? But the point I wanted to make is that, and since we mentioned the treaty, and since I'm supposed to know what is inside the new treaty, maybe a bit better than you, I would like to say that, well, it's not only foreign policy structures that changed, not only more qualified majority votes that are going to take place, not more powers to the European Parliament. There is one new element in the treaty, which is introduction in the fundamental principles and objectives. For the first time, there will be a mention to human dignity, equality, and rights of minorities. It is inscribed. It will be inscribed in the treaty, I think, for the first time, so clearly.
How do you believe that your roles as diplomats in the United States will transform as a result of your membership to this large network? The idea that prior to being members of the European Union, you had these roles as individual countries dealing with a superpower. And now that you are members of this large conglomerate of countries, the strength in numbers, how have you noticed any changes as a result of your new role?
I think the main repercussion is on the presidency. So I think Ambassador de Valera would be able to answer that, and I will tell you my opinion about that.
Well, I thought something of this kind was going to happen. No, I think we have to distinguish three different situations. One is the bilateral relationship, and this goes on as ever. And as you may imagine, all countries and the member states of the European Union are no exception. All countries represented in Washington have a very heavy bilateral agenda, and that means that we are all very busy dealing with that. And for a long time, you can even think that this has not that does not connect. There's not a great connection with the fact that you belong to the European Union in many aspects. That's one aspect. The second is, as a normal member state dealing with the United States, well, when you are discussing the international agenda, even on a national basis, it's difficult for you to speak with the United States without knowing what European Union positions are and what is your own view inside the European Union. Because, as it was mentioned by Ambassador Westendorp before, we are in a world of growing interdependence and in a world where basically all these global challenges are discussed on a daily basis between Europe and the United States. And I move to the third point, presidency. Which means, I mean, the European Union and the United States, I think, have, I would say, the closest network of relationship that I would say exists in the world. All sorts of contacts and all sorts of institutional and less institutional networking, but they are very, very much present. And so, in that period, and especially during your presidency, I can assure you, when we deal not only now I would speak bilateral matters in the sense of EU, United States, but when we deal with the international agenda, the international crisis, and the global challenges, I can assure you that there certainly is a big difference from what it was in the past.
Mm-hmm. It is true, especially on these issues in which the European Union has shared competence. I mean, for instance, in trade. trade issues is dealt with by the Commission. Individual member states have not much to say because we have transferred the competence to the Commission, and then the Commission negotiates with the United States directly, which is the European Union with the United States. In other issues which are less European, so to speak, and they are more bilateral, there is on the one hand, an interest from the United States to deal with countries separately, according to the different situations. They prefer to go, for instance, with two or three in the Iran problem, for instance, or in many other aspects. And the European countries, on the other hand, they also prefer to deal bilaterally with the United States. And so you can find both types of situations. Those issues which are global, as Ambassador Valera said, are dealt with the United States together. The presidency organizes a lot of meetings at different levels, and this is why I said that the main repercussions is on the presidency, that he has a strong burden to unify. But on the other hand, there is a tendency from the United States and from European countries individually to deal bilaterally.
I think you're both too polite to say in the last 6 or 7 years the United States, in the name of being the only superpower, ceased to be a superpower. Thank you very much, both of you, and thank you for the audience. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled Getting to Know the European Union, Portugal and Spain. Our speakers were Joa de Valera, Ambassador of Portugal to the United States, and Carlos Westendorp, Ambassador of Spain to the United States. Moderating tonight's discussion was Alan Berger, Senior Editorial Writer for the Boston Globe. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Mike Toda, with help from Matt Sloan and Ian Kennedy. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.